Thanks very much, David, and thanks very much, Estelle, for having me here, and thanks very much to John McGlenahan for inviting me. So what I'm going to do today is talking about three current issues in financial markets, which hopefully is of interest to you as actuaries as it is to me as someone who works in the financial industry, namely bond market liquidity, long-term interest rates, and China's exchange rate regime. So all three of those are having an important bearing on financial market pricing around the world, including here in Australia, both now and I think are going to do so for quite some time to come. So they may not sound that interrelated, but when we get to the end, I'll pull them all together. So let me start with talking a bit about bond market liquidity. So if you've read any financial market media over the past year, you'd have been hard-pressed to avoid reading an article on bond market liquidity. Indeed, one of the best financial market commentators out there, Matt Levine, devotes a section of his column to people who are worried about bond market liquidity. So this is a daily column. And notwithstanding the fact that it's published daily, he's able to get material every single day to fill that column. So today I'm going to help Matt. Unfortunately, yesterday's column actually said that he's about to stop this. So anyway, I'm going to provide him with some more material and throw my hat into the crowded ring. But not for the first time, as about a year ago today, I talked about this very issue. So why revisit the issue again today? So here are a few reasons. First, 1 year on, there have been a few noteworthy liquidity events in the bond market, including the awkwardly named flash rally in US Treasuries, which actually happened the day after I gave my speech last year. So we'll see how we go this year. There's another event happening tomorrow, which might generate something similar, which is the second reason why I want to talk about this. So the much-anticipated first increase in the Fed funds rate, I'm not saying it's happening tomorrow, but something will happen tomorrow, has been designated, or nothing will happen tomorrow, but that will also generate something, has been designated as a critical test of the state of liquidity in the bond market. And third, while equity markets experienced a very volatile month in August, bond markets were somewhat surprisingly relatively stable, as for that matter were major foreign exchange markets. So that serves to highlight the fact that liquidity and volatility are related, but they're not necessarily the same thing. So what exactly do I mean by bond market liquidity? So generally, I would take it to mean the ability to transact in the bond market without having a material influence on the price. For example, if I want to sell my holdings of Australian government securities, how much will I be able to sell and over what time period without having a significant impact on market pricing? So this question highlights, or framing it that way at least, highlights two points. There's both a quantity dimension, how much can I sell, and a time dimension to liquidity. If I try to sell all my securities at once, my impact on the market is likely to be larger than if I break my order up into small pieces and sell it over a period of time. However, if I do the latter and sell it slowly and gradually, there is a risk that the market price moves against me over that period of time because of news or someone else is selling as well, and I don't get as good an overall price. So the quantity and time element of liquidity is often conflated in the discussion of bond market liquidity. Hence, you can hear it said at the moment simultaneously, it's the best of times and the worst of times in terms of bond market liquidity. Bond market liquidity at what's called the top of book, which is literally the top of the order book, is on a number of metrics as good as it's ever been. That is, my ability to sell a small parcel of bonds very close to the current price is very good. I can probably do it as cheap as I've ever been able to do it. But the depth of book, my ability to sell a large parcel of bonds, is nowhere near as good, and worse than it's been for quite some time. So how can it be that we have both of these two developments occurring at the same time? So the outcome reflects the evolution of the market over recent years in response to technological changes, regulatory changes, as well as institutional appetite for this activity. So in terms of technology, there's been a significant increase in the share of electronic trading in bond markets. In the Australian market, we estimate that electronic trading accounts for around one-third of trading in the Australian government securities market, though it's considerably less than other domestic bond markets here, which are mostly over-the-counter markets. In the US, the share of electronic trading is much higher, more than half of total turnover. So with the increased electronification of the market has come high-frequency trading firms, or HFTs. So these firms are providing increased liquidity at the top of the book for small order sizes, but are not necessarily contributing to the depth of the book, given their preference to trade in small sizes, as well as in many cases they just have a sheer inability to trade in large sizes because of balance sheet constraints. They have contributed to lower transaction costs or lower bid-ask spreads for small orders, but there are question marks around their resilience in times of market stress. The key structural change is the shift in the market share from those who provide immediate and continuous liquidity and have the ability to warehouse risk to those who do the same, i.e. provide immediate and continuous liquidity, but don't have the capacity to warehouse risk. So in this regard, the bond market has followed the well-trodden path of the equity market and later the FX market of increased electronic trading and increased participation by high-frequency traders. So not all would regard the equitisation of the bond market, or for the FX market for that matter, as necessarily as a good thing. And Michael Lewis sold a large number of books writing about how bad this was in the equity market last year. The report recently released by the US authorities examining the flash rally in the US bond market almost a year ago today highlights some of the issues. So to tell you roughly what happened on that day, so it was 15th of October last year. It was about 9:30 in the morning US time, 9:26 I think to be precise, about an hour after a slightly weaker than expected US retail sales release like we got last night, except it was stronger last night. 10-year US Treasury bonds fell rapidly by 16 basis points in 6 minutes. Now, yields go down, price goes up. So hence this is why it's called a flash rally, because the price actually went up rather than down. So most of the time you hear about flash crashes, this was a flash rally, which is not a particularly good way of describing, but anyway, it's what it's called. So 16 basis points down in 6 minutes, and then it just suddenly reversed course and moved up 16 basis points over the next 6 minutes. So 16 basis points, depending on where you come from, might not sound a lot, but if you translate in terms of price, that's a very large price movement down and up in a very short period of time. If you had taken a well-timed coffee break over that 12 minutes and come back to your desk, you wouldn't have noticed that anything had actually happened over that time. So, as I said, the US authorities released a report about a month ago. They haven't come to any conclusions about what caused this to occur, though investigations are continuing. But it does provide information about the structure of the US Treasury market through that time, including the share of high-frequency trading firms, although in the US they've now decided to call these things proprietary trading firms rather than high-frequency trading firms. So one interesting fact is that one firm had a relatively high share of both sides of the market through that period. That is, it was both buying and selling, and it was the largest participant actually on both sides. And in fact, one of the reasons it had such a high share of the trades during that time was actually it was doing a lot of the trades with itself. So it was actually buying and selling to itself through that period of time and accounted for a very large share of the volume going through the market at that time. So another noteworthy fact about what happened then was that the price adjustment was smooth. So when people talk about flash crashes, normally the price is here 1 minute and it's here the next. This was continuous price movement the whole time. There was no gapping in prices. So this event doesn't fit neatly into the category of liquidity event. There was no prolonged dislocation where the price gapped rapidly and stayed there, which is often what people have in mind when thinking about the consequences of lower liquidity. Nevertheless, the fact that such events can occur in arguably the most deep and liquid market, financial market, in the world does mean that we need to understand what's going on here. So as well as the impact of technology, regulation has also had a significant effect. Regulatory changes have increased the cost to banks of intermediation and hence liquidity provision in many markets, and particularly the fixed income market. This has seen a number of participants withdraw completely from the market, and others scale back their activities. Bond desks at banks hold less inventory than they have done historically, given the increased cost of doing so. So this contributes to less depth of book liquidity, though not necessarily less top of book liquidity. So the regulatory changes were intended to have this effect. Liquidity provision was underpriced previously and it was oversupplied. Regulation has increased the cost of providing liquidity and hence it's decreased the quantity supplied. So the direction of change should not be the issue here. Rather, the extent of change should be the focus of debates about bond market liquidity. That is, it is reasonable to ask the question, has regulation increased the cost of liquidity provision too far, with the result that liquidity in the bond market is now too low? So that is certainly a discussion worth having. But in the meantime, liquidity in the bond market today is what it is. It continues to evolve, but it's not going back to what it was anytime soon. So participants in the bond market need to adjust to the current situation rather than simply complain about it. As I said, it's not going to change anytime soon, so people sort of need to get used to it. If transaction costs are higher, particularly for transacting in large sizes, then asset managers and other bondholders need to take account of that in the way they execute in the market. For example, one solution may be to execute more slowly in smaller parcel sizes. Execution certainly needs to be more nimble and considered than in the past. But perhaps more importantly, the increased transaction costs in terms of liquidity and execution should actually be taken into account in the way an asset manager actually constructs their portfolio. I mean, it is reasonable to ask the question, why am I actually transacting here and do I actually really need to be doing that? So the difference in transaction costs across various asset classes need to be taken into account. If transaction costs are higher, maybe I should transact less. That's normally what happens when something whose cost increases, I do less of it. Do I really need to be selling? In some cases, I don't have much choice because the need to transact may be driven by the mandate I have been given. And if any of you have had any experience in changing mandates, that takes a hell of a long time. So at least, though, you need to start the conversation with the provider of the mandate, highlighting the higher transaction costs and the implication that has for the portfolio. Or maybe I need to transact because of redemption flows out of my fund. People are pulling their money out of the fund. I have to sell the asset to provide them with some cash. So in that situation, if transaction costs are higher, I may need to think about holding a higher liquidity buffer than I did in the past. So if the cost of obtaining liquidity in the market for my bond portfolio is higher than it used to be, then I need to think about weighing it up against the cost of holding more liquidity to accommodate those redemption flows. So let me now turn to another concern that often is expressed around bond market liquidity, namely that with the decline in intermediation by banks, the likelihood of market dislocation is higher. So this is the thing that often comes up in terms of if the Fed raises rates tomorrow, then the bond market is just going to go into meltdown. So the taper tantrum, or so-called taper tantrum of 2013, is often invoked as an example of this. And if you can remember what happened there a couple of years back, saw a rapid rise in bond yields in a number of emerging markets, not in the US, following indications that the Fed was going to wind down its quantitative easing program. So as I said about a year ago, I think the issue is not so much one of a decline in liquidity as much as a decline in the capacity to warehouse risk in the market. So in the past, when there was a large sell-off in bond markets, liquidity was actually never that great. So back in 94, when the Fed, just after the Fed raised rates, there was a large sell-off in bond markets with a market structure which was somewhat different from what it is today. So a bank, just like any other investor, has no more desire to catch a falling knife. If the price is falling rapidly, they're not going to get in the way of that in a hurry. Bid-ask spreads widen considerably and the depth of book deteriorates. That's always happened. However, in addition to a decline in liquidity provision, banks now have much less risk warehousing capacity. They are less able to be nimble buyers of assets. So a bank's not going to get in the way of a falling price, but when they think it's fallen far enough, they're going to step in quickly. And that's generally what happened in the past. The banks are generally amongst the first to step in and buy when they feel that the price had overshot. So this is one important aspect of what I mean by warehousing absorbing risk. As a result of regulatory changes as well as their own risk tolerances, banks are much less willing and able to do this today. So many real money investors, and by that I mean asset managers and the like, are not able to move so quickly to take advantages of overshooting prices. The degree of discretion is generally not as large. Mandates often generally don't allow them to do it. They can't stray too far from benchmarks, and it takes a long time, as I said earlier, to change mandates to respond to change in market circumstances, like years, let alone months. Are there other participants in the market who are able to move so rapidly and agilely to perform that function today? I'm sure they exist, but I'm not so sure there are enough of them, and I suppose we'll find out the answer to that soon, whether there are enough of them. So if there's less capacity to do this, then prices will move by larger amounts and remain away from equilibrium for longer. Volatility will be higher. That's not necessarily a bad thing, it just is what it is. But with higher volatility, the distribution of price movements have fatter tails, overshooting will be more likely, and that can have long-lasting and more deleterious consequences. So given that, some have recommended that central banks step in and play the role of market maker of last resort. So without debating the merits of that proposal today, it is worth pointing out that the term market maker of market market maker of last resort is misrepresenting what's going on here. A market maker makes two-way prices. I buy something and then I sell it off on the other side, generally fairly quickly. In a dislocated market, most of the trading is one way. The central bank will only be buying. It won't be selling anytime soon. So a more appropriate description is buyer of last resort, with the risk to the central bank's balance sheet that comes from performing that role. Let me talk something which is possibly of a little more direct relevance to actuaries and switch gears and talk a bit about whether the government bond rate is still the appropriate risk-free yield. Is it lower now than it used to be, and will it stay there? So on the first question, that is it still the appropriate risk-free yield? The answer is still yes, I think. Ultimately, the risk-free yield would be something that approximates the growth rate of the economy. And on that basis, the government bond yield is still doing a pretty good job. So yes, policy actions in some of the major economies might have pushed bond yields globally lower than it might otherwise have been, but these policy actions themselves reflect the growth circumstance in which we find ourselves. In Australia, partly a result of those policy actions elsewhere, we have seen foreign holdings of Australian government securities increase to over 75% a couple of years back. It's a bit lower than that today. Again, I don't see the fact that there's a lot of foreigners holding our bonds these days as distorting the government bond yield, but again, reflects the world that we actually live in. So if government bond yields are around historic lows, should that be reflected in the discount rates used in actuarial calculations? And how long is that period of low rates going to last? I'm not going to answer that question quite directly, but again, it's useful to think of it in terms of economic growth rates. So secular stagnation, most famously put forward by Larry Summers, is often put forward as a reason why growth rates will be lower than they used to be. There are various theories of secular stagnation around, but a number of them boil down to the proposition that the rate of innovation and technological progress will be lower now and in the future than it's been in the past. So personally, I find that very defeatist. This claim has been made any number of times over the past number of hundred years, including by people like Malthus, and generally it's proven to be wrong. Actually, we know it's been proven to be wrong up until now. Now, one day it might actually be right, but it's not clear to me that that day is today. And as I said, ultimately, it's a pretty pessimistic view of the future. And I don't particularly see any reason why we should give up today and think that there's not going to be any technological progress from now to eternity. So I don't buy the secular stagnation argument. I think it's not one reason why growth rates are going to be lower permanently. In Australia, one factor which does have a significant influence on real growth rates is the rate of population growth. That has slowed in Australia of late, which means there are some grounds to believe that the medium-term growth rate of the economy has slowed. But, and if that's the case, then discount rates should probably be lower. But the orders of magnitude we are talking about here are really small. You know, the shift in population growth we're talking about is of the order of 0.25%. Now, I know for actuaries, by the time you accumulate that over a long, compound that over a number of years, that can actually end up to be a big number. But a degree of error around our knowledge of the long-term growth rate is probably a lot more than 0.25%. So I still think, as a result of all of that, that the government bond yield is the best measure to use in the, as a risk-free yield. There may be reasons to believe it's structurally lower than it used to be, but I don't think the fact that that there's not going to be any more technological progress in the future is one of those. Let me just finish by saying a few words about China and its exchange rate, which has been a little bit of that written about that of late, and picking up some of the points which were released in the board minutes, RBA board minutes we put out yesterday. So as you might know by reading the paper, if anyone still does read the paper, these Chinese authorities made a notable change to their FX regime on the 11th of August, so about a month ago. So on that day, they moved further down the path of moving towards a more market-determined exchange rate for China, a development which should be welcome. The initial effect was for the Chinese exchange rate to depreciate by around 4.5% over a few days. That's actually not all that big in the general scheme of exchange rate moves, although it generated a disproportionately large amount of coverage and commentary from the rest of the world. The other thing to keep in context about that move down was it came after the Chinese exchange rate had moved up by 15% over the previous year, as it moved up in lockstep with the US dollar. But I want to focus on one particular aspect of the change that they put through about a month ago. So as part of their efforts to limit the appreciation of the RMB over more than a decade, the Chinese authorities had accumulated $4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. So it's a fairly big number. This occurred in an environment of a sizable current account surplus combined with significant flows of capital into China, so people investing money into China, as well as very stringent restrictions on the ability of Chinese citizens to take money out of China. However, that environment has changed over the last few years. China still runs a current account surplus, though it's a bit smaller than it was a few years back. But most importantly, China is now experiencing sizable capital outflows as they've eased up on the restrictions of the ability of Chinese citizens to take money out of the country. So as a result, over the last year or so, in the face of these capital outflows, the Chinese authorities haven't been intervening to keep the currency down. They've actually been intervening to offset those capital outflows and keep the currency up. So consequently, China's foreign exchange reserves have declined by around half a trillion US dollars over the past 9 months or so. We actually don't know what they're selling. So half a trillion dollars is a reasonably large amount of stuff to be selling into the market. We don't know what they're selling because we don't actually know what their composition of their reserves holdings are. It probably involves some US treasuries and other sovereign bonds. But at the same time, so as we don't know what they're selling, we also don't know what the Chinese citizens who are bringing the money out of the country are actually buying, beyond the odd piece of real estate. But I'm guessing they probably haven't bought around half a trillion dollars worth of real estate around the world. So the Chinese authorities are selling half a trillion dollars, Chinese citizens are buying half a trillion dollars. Both of those numbers are very large numbers, and they're probably having a first-order influence on financial markets at the moment. And one way to think about it is that the 10 years' worth of reserve accumulation that the Chinese authorities did was basically accumulating foreign assets for China writ large on behalf of the private sector who couldn't invest abroad. Now the private sector can invest, there will be a switch from the public sector to the private sector as the private sector accumulates foreign assets that they've always wanted to hold while the public sector sells down its holdings. That is, a fair part of what's going on at the moment is a shift in who is holding foreign assets in China, not necessarily a large shift in the total quantity of foreign assets being held by China or the Chinese people, both on the private and public side. What matters for global financial markets is the difference in the portfolio choice between those two groups. Does the private sector want to hold the same sort of assets that SAFE, the investment arm or the reserve management arm of the Chinese authorities, been holding over the last decade or so? That's really what matters in terms of what's going on in markets at the moment. So let me finish by just trying to pull those things together. I've talked about bond market liquidity, long-term yields, and China's exchange rate. They're interrelated at the moment because of what I was just talking about. China's foreign exchange reserves and the selling down of those probably in part is involving sales of US treasuries and other sovereign bonds because of their greater liquidity. The fact that they can sell bonds in one of the most liquid markets in the world to get the money they need to intervene in their exchange market means they're probably selling US treasuries. That's probably having an effect on global long-term yields. We're seeing an unusual environment at the moment where a risk-off environment, so when things go bad, called a risk-off environment, is associated with sales of the risk-free asset, US treasuries, by a large market participant rather than what normally happens, which is purchases. On bond market liquidity, the decline in liquidity is in part a desired outcome of regulation. Whether it's fallen too far can be debated, but the situation isn't going to change anytime soon, and market participants basically need to just get used to it. They have to consider carefully how their execution will function in an environment of lower liquidity, and they may also need to adjust the construction of their portfolios. Whether the changed market environment we're seeing at the moment is more conducive to temporary flash rallies, or rallies for that matter, or permanent dislocations remains to be seen. I'll find out tomorrow. The latter, i.e. permanent dislocations, are a significantly greater concern than the former, those sort of temporary flash crashes. The simplest way to deal with a flash crash is actually to take a well-timed coffee break and miss it. All of these three issues are going to be with us for quite a while to come. So in the end, as I said, they are what they are, and basically I think people in the financial market participants just need to adjust to the current environment rather than wishing it was something else. So with that pithy piece of advice, let me finish there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Steve Hayward from EY, question for both of you, maybe directed towards Guy first, around liquidity. You mentioned that liquidity is more expensive than it was before the GFC. And it's around the committed liquidity facility. And I'll probably irritate all the ADIs by saying I thought it was surprisingly generous in price. Not expensive, and for a set of reasons, you can see that in the financial markets and the cost of liquidity. No one seemed to complain about the costs, I think that was an indication. and also collectively the ADIs have asked for more than you're prepared to give them in total. So I was curious as to whether you were inclined to price it more expensively.
So as owner or founder of the committed liquidity facility, I'm going to be very defensive in my answering this, because I actually think, of course, it's been designed perfectly, but as I would. But so let me explain how we came up with the price. So what we're trying to do is replicate the liquidity premium in high-quality liquid assets. That's how we tried to calculate the price. We've got something on our website that goes into some more gory detail as to how we came up with that price. We are not... So, all we're trying to do is replicate the liquidity premium in bond markets in roughly normal times. And our best guess, and it's a pretty difficult thing to do, is 15 basis points is pretty close to the mark. I actually think if you look at the behaviour of banks, actually they're reasonably indifferent between the two. There are higher rates of return on other assets that reside on their balance sheet, but that's because they've got credit risk in them. We are not trying to extract the credit risk premium, because they're still wearing that credit risk, against which they have to do a whole bunch of other things that Wayne talked about. So, I mean, I would say that the thing is appropriately priced because we came up with the price. But the motivation for the price was to replicate the liquidity premium. The other thing I suppose I'd point out is that this liquidity, and Wayne mentioned this during his talk, is that liquidity provision has always been there implicitly. What we're actually doing now is make people actually pay for it. So the price prior to the beginning of this year was actually zero. Now you're making the banks actually pay 15 basis points, which is higher than zero.
Hi, I'm Sophia Rodriguez from Market News, and this question is for Guy Debelle. You mentioned in your speech about what assets the capital outflow from China, you don't know what they're buying. What are the chances that capital could find its way in Australia, and what impact would it have on the exchange rate?
The answer is the same as for any other financial market. We neither know what the private part of China is buying, nor do we know what the public part of China is selling. And it's the net, as I said, it's the difference between those two portfolios which makes the difference. So I know as little about it here as I do about in any other market. I mean, the opacity around what people have estimates about what the composition of SAFE's assets are, but they're purely pretty much guesses, sometimes slightly more informed guesses. As I said, you know, we've got one of the largest asset managers, well, the largest asset manager pretty much in the world, although the Fed keeps on reminding me that they've got a larger balance sheet than SAFE does. But anyway, they have $3.5 trillion worth of foreign assets. That's a big number. We just don't have a good much visibility as to what exactly they're holding, beyond the fact that if you've got a $3.5 trillion portfolio, you're probably holding something of everything.
Guy, I'm going to ask you to chance your arm on US official interest rates.
I don't know.
When might they increase?
I don't know. I mean,
and supposing they were to increase, what would be the impact, the immediate impact on the Australian economy? You did touch it in your speech.
No. I mean, so the market has a 1 in 3 expectation for tomorrow. It's priced by January next year. That's what the market thinks. Yeah. My guess is if there will be, I'd be surprised if there wasn't a bit of volatility when they raise rates. I think there are, as I've said, I think I said this this time last year, when it also the market had a 1 in 3 expectation of a rise in interest rates a few months out from that. That there is some stuff out there which is predicated on basically zero funding costs. That probably doesn't work when funding costs aren't zero. And we'll probably fall over. What it is, it's not entirely clear. Are we more confident it's not directly on the books of the core banking system? Yes, which is potentially different to previous episodes. Will there be an increase in volatility? It would be surprising if there wasn't, because historically that's always happened. I mean, I suppose the other point to make is that there's a couple of things which I think are interesting to reflect on. One is, it's 9 years since the Fed last raised interest rates. That's a decently large chunk of people in the market have never experienced an environment where rates actually go up. Most of them have actually never experienced an environment where rates actually change in the US, let alone go up. So that I think will be interesting to see how that goes. as I said, we've had a long time of this sort of environment, and some behaviours have probably evolved which are not going to be sustainable when rates are no longer at zero, and you know, stuff will probably happen as a result. Every time we've had a rise in US interest rates in the past, of you know, been reasonably few and far between, things seem to happen after that. You would have thought, I mean, the only thing I would say this time around is that this is the most well-telegraphed rate rise in the history of rate rises. So if you're not ready for it, you sure as hell have been warned, and really you've got no excuse. You know, the exact timing in the end really is neither here nor there. But as I said, you have no excuse this time around for not being prepared.
Thank you for not dropping too much of a dead bat on that question. I think we have a question here.
I've got a loud voice. Robert Armstrong, the NAB. I just wondered, Wayne, perhaps Guy, there's a lot of talk about digital disruption and changing the platforms and the way people do business these days. I just wondered how both the global and the local regulators are thinking about the future impact of that on the banking system as it moves forward.
It's a good question I don't necessarily have a good answer for, because there's a lot of thinking going on but not necessarily a lot of answers. But just as no doubt in all the organisations that you work for, there's a lot of thought being given to, well, what does it mean? What does it mean for individual business lines? What does it mean for individual products? I mean, regulators having to think the same thing. What does it mean for our structures, our frameworks, etc.? Because in many cases, we have legislative frameworks, regulatory frameworks, supervisory approaches that are all sort of built almost in the sense of the old-fashioned concept of a bank. It's a legal entity with physical assets, and you can go and you can almost touch them. And that's, you know, the world is going completely in the opposite direction. And the boundary of a bank, where does it start and finish, is becoming much more difficult. So we have to think quite hard about it, and there's obviously the dimensions that are positive in the sense of there's opportunities for banks who are nimble and ahead of the game. There's the competitive threat issue that has to be thought through. There's the security issue, the cyber security issues that have to be thought through. So all of these things are certainly on the agenda. There isn't, I think, probably like industry, regulators are still grappling with knowing where are these things, how are these things going to play out, and therefore what's the right response to them. It's hard for regulators to try and maybe even dangerous for regulators to try and think, as I said in my remark, we sort of know how these are going to play out and therefore set up a regime in anticipation of them, because inevitably the world will go a different way to whatever we think.
I mean, to pick up on your theme of your session, I mean, that's one where I think reactive, you know, it's reaction, not driving. And that's been true for the last, you know, few hundred years, really. There's been technological changes which have come along, which have changed the way that that financial intermediation has been provided. Not all of those technological innovations have been for the better, and that's probably going to be the case this time around as well. Some of them clearly have been for the better, some of them not necessarily so. But, you know, there's always, in this part of the space, I think, much more of a reactive thing rather than necessarily a proactive, just because of the inherent difficulty in being able to tell what the future's going to bring.
Elaine Grace, the Actuaries Institute. The Bank of England has recently started conducting a study on the economic risk of climate change and stranded assets. I guess I'm just wondering whether the RBA or APRA have taken any similar studies or plan to in the future.
We certainly think about that issue. Have we done the sort of detailed study that the Bank of England has done? No, we haven't yet. We're observing what all the banks are doing in thinking about their approach to climate change and how they want to respond to it. We're thinking about how the superannuation sector, or observing how the superannuation sector responds in terms of its investment strategies, etc. But we haven't yet got to a view ourselves about that we feel we need to opine on those sorts of things just at this point.
So I just say two things. One, purely from a market's point of view, I mean, one question to ask is it priced, right? And also, if you think, and over a long horizon, I mean, so you think about it having an impact over a long horizon, it obviously has an impact in terms of superannuation decisions, which are a long horizon decision. But if you look at, the composition of the ASX 200 today, it is not going to look like that in 20 years' time for any number of events, one of which will be climate change. And the question is how much of that is actually priced, reflected in current pricing over something which is ultimately a reasonably long-lived thing. The other thing I'd say, though, is that, as you may well know, that this is an item on the FSB's, quite high on the FSB's agenda, partly reflecting the fact that the chair of the FSB is also the governor of the Bank of England. But nevertheless, it's an item high on that agenda at the moment and for the next while. Indeed, I believe there's a conference in London on this topic in the next couple of days, FSB conference. So the focus on that in the global regulatory community, I suppose, is there at the moment.
So it's an international debate beyond models. It's kind of also about the place of risk sensitivity in banking capital. Do you have any comments on your views about what a loss of risk sensitivity, how that would play out?
So, what a loss of what? It's more you, isn't it, than me? This is basically the history of the Basel Committee, on which but in the sense of this, it reflects the iterations over the Basel Committee's history, on which Wayne is a hell of a lot better comment than I am, given his direct involvement in it. But I mean, to some extent, the original capital, but if I may get this wrong, Basel I was basically non-risk based capital.
Well, very simple.
And then Basel II was an acknowledgement of that, and then Basel III is probably somewhere in between. But I said you're much better to describe that than I.
Something. It's like the regulator putting a price on risk, and the price the regulator puts on risk is not necessarily what you might observe as the market price of the risk or your assessment of what that right risk is. You know, most institutions have developed some form of economic capital estimate that is used to price and allocate capital and measure returns, etc. And that's your estimate of the economic risk of particular businesses, and you therefore work out the prices and rewards that you expect from those businesses. When regulators come in with something different, particularly if that something different is binding and above your estimate, then it drives not necessarily the most efficient behaviours. And the whole idea of bringing models into the regulatory framework was to try and better align regulatory measures of risk with genuine economic measures of risk or prices of risk. Now, so we think that's better because it's more likely to generate efficient behaviour, drive sensible risk-taking if the regulatory price of risk is consistent with what we perceive to be the real price of risk. If you take the models out or take risk sensitivity away, then you risk driving a bigger wedge between what people think is the right price of risk and what the regulators impose, and therefore you in a sense are creating a distortion, and in a sense people won't necessarily be making efficient decisions in terms of where they allocate their capital. And so that's the question we have. The thing that stops us going right the way down that path is simply, how do you get these reliable measures that regulators can trust?